Thank you, Jane. Thanks for coming out. If there's anybody in here that's ever gotten Allison and myself confused, she's the one with the screwed up last name. I'm the one with the screwed up first name. So, and Jane was correct. When I come to a BIF, I get about, I'm going to guess, at least five versions of my name. From time to time, it is Dare, just like I dare you. But if you've been calling me the wrong thing forever, I would expect you to keep calling me whatever you have been calling me, as long as it's clean. I don't like dirty words. So Alice and I are going to have the presentation for you today, and there will be a quiz, and you guys all have your little clicker devices, rapid response devices, or whatever you want to call them. Just a word of caution before we get started. There's three knots associated with those little devices. The first knot is it is not a calculator. You're not going to have to do any math in this whole session, right? Well, oh, I take that back. Yeah, you do. But you're not going to need a calculator for it, okay? The second knot is it is not a remote control. Will not turn on your TV, will not open your garage door. And the last knot is the most important. It is not yours. It is mine, and I want them back. So we have people posted at the door, and those gals are tougher than they look, so I wouldn't try and sneak out with one if I were you. All right. How you use those devices is I'm going to put some questions up, some multiple choice type questions, and you have the chance I'll tell you when we get to the first one, but you just press the number that corresponds with the answer. Welcome to sunny California. Allison invited John Pollock and Dorian and myself out to do a little fly fishing and go and visit Jack Callie up at his place, and we were supposed to do some work too. But she was preparing us all for the sunny California, and we had a snowstorm while we were up there. So for those of you that thought the rain was bad, the snow was a little worse. All right, now you get to start using your devices. We were going to tag team this, but we couldn't decide as to who was going to get to show which slides, and we got into a bit of an argument as to who was the better presenter and the more entertaining presenter, so we're going to leave it up to you. So the first question that I'm going to ask you is, which one of us do you want to give this presentation, Allison or me? So if you want Allison, click one. If you want me, click two.
Is it working?
It's working.
All right. I'm somewhat patient on the first couple of these, and I lose my patience after a little while, so that might dictate who wins this thing, I guess. I better be quiet. All right. Everybody in? This slide was put in to prove a point. You don't always get what you ask for. And for my fans in the audience, it was rigged, so if you pushed me, which I know most of you did, your device is not faulty, so don't throw it away. It still works. All right, this is a picture of what? Now you get to use your device. Now we're getting a little more serious. See, this thing's going to build momentum. We're going to start off a little slow, and we'll build some momentum. So all in, all done? Everybody, I hope, knows the right answer is two. How about that? We got 100% right again. This one was not rigged. Y'all all got that one right, so I'm very proud of you. All right. How many times did Chuck Ramsey swear today?
During
his presentation. I'm sorry, I did not. Very good point. See, they're smarter than I thought, because there's several of these where you do need some more information. So, yeah, just during his presentation, just the ones that were audible that we could hear. It was twice. So I did have some wrong answers, and unless some of you can hear a little better than I can. I'm not going to go into that, but you know, there is a whole comic routine about what constitutes a cuss word, but we're not going to do that one right now. Any George Carlin fans in the room? All right. Who did not listen to Dave Daly because you agree with? Remember, Dave said, this is a fair question, because he said that some of you weren't going to listen because you agreed with him. Some weren't going to listen because you disagreed with him. I'm quite confident some of you didn't listen because you were bored, and others of you were hungover. And now there might be some of you that did actually listen, and if you did, then you can press 5. Well, how about that? They will be pleased. All right. Now we're going to get a little more serious. Now I want to know who you represent. Now, some of you might fit more than one category. If you do, put the one that you would like to be fit in, because if you press it twice, it's going to just take your last answer. So, and that's another part about these clickers that you should know. If you think you've put the wrong answer in, all you have to do is press it again before I press my button, and it just takes your last response. So put whichever one that you feel the most associated with. All right, so we have primarily seed stock producers in the room, which is not unusual for a BIF. I think that is typically our biggest contingent. Quite a few commercial producers. That looks like about 16%. I'm going to have to pull my glasses out. Allied industry, a few. Quite a few academics, as usual. And pretty slight on the packer feeder side of things, which, once again, is fairly typical. All right, how many cows do you have? This is mama cows that you run on your operation. So some of you know that not everybody is a cattle producer, so obvious answer there is going to be 0. But find your range in there. 2 is less than 50, then we go 50 to 100 for 3. 4 is 100 to 200, 200 to 500, 500 to 1,000. Over 1,000 is number 7. All right, we got quite a distribution here. We have 2% that's over 1,000. We have a considerable number that are still about 17% that are 500 to 1,000, 19% the 200 to 500, 21% and 100 to 200. Only 13% that don't have cattle. So we have quite a number of cattle, I think, represented in the room today. So how many, now this is for the commercial producers, because the seed stock, I'm really not interested in what you have to say about this one. So just for the commercial producers, how many bulls do you plan to purchase this year? Okay. All right, so there's a third of you nodded, and that's not unusual. In these economic times that we're in particularly, a lot of times the first thing we do is we do kind of give up on some of the bulls that we're buying. We don't replenish quite as often, so I'm not surprised to see that. About half of you are buying 1 to 2, and then a few of you are buying in the larger numbers. But some bulls going to be bought. Now for you seed stock guys, it's your turn. How many bulls do you plan to sell this year? All righty. That's pretty even distribution across there. Between the less than 10, about a fifth of you each way right across. So quite a few bulls going to be sold as well, with about 20% of you that will actually sell over 100 bulls this year. That's pretty impressive. Okay, now going back to one of our BIF talks, this was discussed at one of the talks in terms of currently how we determine EPDs. So now we're getting into a little bit of just how well you guys were listening and paying attention. So how do we currently determine EPDs? By phenotypes alone, pedigrees alone, genotypes alone, both phenotypes and pedigrees is 4. Both phenotypes and genotypes is 5, and both pedigrees and genotypes is 6, or all of the above. Not all of you answered that one. Now, some of you are a little scared, I guess. Now we're getting into the tougher questions. Scattered out a little bit. Nobody thought just phenotypes. A few of you, looks like, thought pedigrees alone. Somebody thought genotypes alone. Both two and three, so that's pedigrees with genotypes, and then all of the above. Actually, currently, unless there's one that I'm not aware of, the right answer was number four, both one and two. So phenotypes and pedigrees are the current system of computing EPDs. So high bit of accuracy in how you guys answered that one. Now, what, if you've listened to some of these talks, and there were a lot of talks, particularly on the first day, about how they're proposing in the future that that EPDs will be determined. And I want you to step out there a pretty good ways in terms of the most, what's the word I'm looking for? The most aggressive approach, I guess, to how the proposal to how EPDs will be determined in the future. All of the above. Well, that's probably the one that I would say is probably the next step down the line. But what I heard in some of the talks was at some point in time, if we can ever get enough coverage, then it's going to even eliminate the need for the pedigrees and the phenotypes if we get to that point. If we get to the point where we truly know what every one of the SNPs that are available are controlling, then theoretically we don't need a pedigree or a phenotype. Now, that would be very aggressive to get to that point, and I don't think that's right around the corner, but I think the one that most of you answer, that is the one where we start incorporating the genotypes into our current method, which is the phenotypes and the pedigrees. And so that's what's probably just around the corner. So what percent, if you'll remember back, I think this was Dr. Goddard's talk, he was talking about the height gene, if you'll remember, in humans. And he was talking about the control that a major gene had. So what percent of the phenotypic variation do the major genes account for? Now, he was talking about human height, but they were saying that that it's probably pretty close for most of the traits we deal with, too. And if you'll remember, he gave us a value. Does anybody remember what that value was? Here we go. Most of you, about half of you, got it right. It was 0.3%. That's not a lot, is it, folks? That's not a lot. 0.3%. And Allison, nobody got 300%. So we're very pleased. We put that one in there just to see if there were any DNA companies here in the audience. Obviously, there are not. So half of the people got it right. So about 0.3%. So any one of these genes is not going to have a whole lot of influence on those traits, particularly from a phenotypic standpoint. Okay? Here's another thing that has been talked about considerably during this BIS session, and that is if a panel is developed using a Boss Taurus breed, it usually works, one, in only that breed, two, in all Boss Taurus breeds, three, in all beef cattle, and four, in all cattle. Uh-oh. How'd that happen? What's y'all answer? Oh, there it was. It must have thought I double-clicked. There we go. All right. 56% of you said in only that breed. 42% of you said in all Boss Taurus breeds. A few of you said all beef cattle. And it was kind of interesting when Alice and I put this slide together. We had some debate as to what was said, and it's pretty interesting that you guys felt about that 50-50 range there too. I felt like I was hearing a little bit more that most of the data was showing that it was only for that one breed. And Allison was pointing out some of the cases where it would at least go across some of the other Boss Taurus breeds anyway. And then the closer related those breeds are, it seems like, of course, the better they do. The further away we get, and certainly when we start getting to trying to look at a Boss Taurus over onto a Boss Indicus, then we really fall apart in terms of how well we're able to do it. Now, the good news on this is that, as they told us, we're getting bigger and bigger panels, right? And the bigger those panels are, the more SNPs they can find, the better they will be able to go across breed, is at least theoretically where we hope to be with all of this marker information. So where we are now is hopefully not where we're going to be in the near future, that it's going to get better and better as we get more information in. So which is better for an RFI value? That was Dr. Karsten's talked about that today. If you remember, is a high RFI value mean more feed efficient, or does a low RFI value mean more feed efficient? Okay, most of you were paying attention and got that one right. It is the lower values. Lower values are what we're seeking when we're looking for RFI. So if some of you guys have been getting some RFI data and been selecting for that higher number, I hate to tell you, but you need to do a U-turn and go the other direction, because you're not going the right way. So we do need to be looking at those as lower values. All right, now I know this is a little silly, but this is actually a question that's in there for a different polling survey we do, but who has heard about DNA testing for beef cattle? I hope I know what the answer here is going to be. All right, everybody's at least been awake for at least one talk during this BIF session, and probably even before that. All right, next step, who has collected samples from their cattle for DNA testing? One is yes, two is no. So about 85% of you have done it. That's pretty impressive. That's a bigger number, I guess, than I was expecting. So quite a few people have tested at least for something. So we'll delve a little deeper and see what we can come up with. Who has tested their cattle for the sample traits? These are things like coat color, horn pulled, the genetic defects, some of those kind of traits. Who has done that kind of testing?
That cow
fold
or horn?
Yes. Okay, 65% have at least done one of those types of tests, and that number probably has gone up significantly here in recent history. All right, so let's look at this a little bit. So if you breed a simply inherited carrier cow, let's use polled horns for example. So we have a polled cow, big P, little P, to a non-carrier bull. So a polled. What is the chance that the offspring will have the recessive phenotype? Told you you'd have to do a little math. All right. Oh, we're kind of all over the board. Okay, about a quarter of you said zero. About half of you said 25%. The other half somewhat larger than that. If you breed to a polled bull, a homozygous polled bull, you will get all polled calves. Now, they can be a carrier, though, right? So that was the question that we said which one would have the recessive phenotype. So in other words, which ones would be horned? The right answer was zero. Okay? So about a quarter of you. So we're going to have to work on our math there a little bit. So about a quarter of you said zero. All right, everybody understand that, right? So to show the recessive, they had to be a double recessive, right? And everybody knows they get one gene from each parent. So on the cow, she gave both a horned and a polled gene. The bull only gave a polled gene. So we know they're going to get at least one polled gene from the bull. So that's why all the calves are going to be polled and not show the recessive phenotype. All right, so let's look at it from a genetic defect standpoint. And if we're talking about a genetic defect that is recessive, in other words, it exhibits itself when we have the double recessive, if you breed a simply inherited genetic defect carrier cow to a defect-free bull, what is the chance that the offspring will result in the genetic defect? Everybody there? Here we go. Very good. Y'all caught on quick. There's nothing different. Well, if it's a simple recessive genetic defect, that makes it no different. And that may prove the point that Mark Tallman was talking about yesterday and when he was talking about his inbreeding plan to try and account for genetic defects. He says that genetic defects tend to, you know, make people a little nervous. They think it kind of propagates on its own. And so I think that may illustrate that because we just talked about the fact that, you know, that it should have been zero because that's the exact same example as the horn pole that we wanted to get you straightened out on and it should have applied exactly the same here. Yes, ma'am? Do you want to see the results?
I was thinking I would
okay.
I thought it was the offspring carrying
that. No. Right. Okay. I can see that, though. Because for a second there, I thought that's how I'd asked it. So. All right. We already did that one. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. The answer to that one would have been zero as well. Oh, how many of them would be carriers? That's going to be, what is it, 25%. Right. Right. 50%. Yeah. Where's one of those calculators y'all have? Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, 50%. So when you mate two carriers together, then you get 25% of the potential to have the double recessive and be the genetic defect. Right, Joe?
Yes.
All right. So who has tested their cattle for the complex or multigenic traits, quantitative traits, whatever you want to call them, the ones that we see the three companies have a multitude of tests out there for us now. So who has actually tested for some of the quantitative traits, marbling, tenderness, some of these? All right, 35%, quite a bit lower that have actually started utilizing some of this technology. All right, which of the if you have used some of these tests, which of the ones have you done? Have you done marbling, tenderness, feed efficiency, some combination of those three, all of them, or none? So that you get to still answer it, I guess, if you answered none before, too. Okay, still a bunch of you that have it. So Most of you that have done it have either done a combination of those or most of them. Very few of you have just selected one of those particular traits, which that typically is a good price break with most of the companies, I think, that to add on some new ones is typically doesn't cost you very much. So which of the tests that are out there and available did you use? Did you use the GeneStar, Pfizer, Bovigen panel, the Igenity, MMI, more than one of the above? If you used multiple companies, you just can't remember which company you used, but you know you pulled hair and sent it in, or you haven't?
Are you talking about just from Marbley, color?
I'll open it up for anything. If you've used any of the companies for genetic testing. And if you said it's different, then you can press a different button. Okay, so pretty wide distribution there in terms of which of the companies you've used with no huge winners or losers. So how much would you be willing to pay for a marbling test?
How accurate is it?
That's what we were hoping, that you would that someone would come in and ask something like that. How do you want to answer that, Allison? I'll leave that up to you.
Well, I think that was the kind of teachable moment was that it's really difficult to make that decision without having the information you need to kind of determine how accurate that test is or how much it improves accuracy. It's like saying, how much would you pay for a car? Well, it's a lot of carriers, and so you kind
of need more information. So I was going to put in there a thing that said I don't have enough information to make that decision, but then we offered to pick that, and there'd be a long answer, and that must be the right one, and we already said that. So I think I just needed to see what we got here, but that's very true. So tell us. So we'll say current test available. If this BIF is clarified exactly what accuracy is there, then you've learned more than I have.
Derek?
Yeah?
Would you also have to stratify by feedstock or commercial producer? I mean, there's different value bases.
That's a good point, but this will be general because I don't think any of the companies are going to sell them for a different price to seed stock or commercial. It's probably going to be... So,
asking the willingness to pay.
Right. How much are you willing to pay? Right. So if you're a commercial guy and it has a smaller impact, then you would likely put a smaller value there. And see, that might be the whole thing that we're talking about with this anyway. I mean, depending on what we can do with the pricing structure of some of this, if it's doing a really good job but it's only profitable to a seed stock guy, then that might be the case. Okay, a bunch of you are still on the fence on this one. Don't want to jump in. Everybody else wanted to keep it as cheap as possible, and I don't blame you. No, you can, yeah. Right, right. And absolutely, that's a good point by Allison. She's saying that that you need to have a way of capturing that value as well in order to, and I guess it was Dave, I think, that was talking about that today, talking about that with every decision he makes, that he puts it to that test right there, is will it put money back in my pocket? And so that's a good point. So how much would you be willing to pay for a tenderness test? And let's assume this tenderness test is very, very good. So?
Then I want to know whether the breed associations are incorporated into their EPDs.
Into their EPDs for what?
Tenderness.
Nobody has an EPD for tenderness, but... Okay. All right, that's right. Sure did.
So is it going to go into DVDs or is it just a test?
Ask Sally. We hope that it's going to get in there.
Okay.
Okay, not much difference. Now this is one of those this is probably the most curious of all the ones, and I think that based on at least the validation stuff, this is the one that we're probably at least currently able to do the best with, I think, from a DNA standpoint. What's the problem with this trait in general? Is our ability to get paid for it. And it really, something's going to have to change industry-wide if we're going to have put a lot of selection into it. And some of you are willing to pay some pretty good money for a trait, I guess, in hopes that someday it will be that you will have some way of getting paid for it. Now, you know, another way people look at things is trying to help out the industry as a whole. And yes, it may, and it might be very breed-specific. If you're a breed that has some tenderness problems, then you're probably going to be willing to pay a little bit more to try and get more tenderness in your product than somebody that already has a pretty decent product as well.
Another consideration would be that there isn't another good source of data. You can do marbling scores, which is
right. Absolutely. I mean, that is the sole source of making genetic improvement for the most part for tenderness, other than the Simmental's EPD. All right, why do you use DNA tests? If you are one of the people that said that, and particularly from a seed stock producer standpoint, I guess for the first one anyway, a commercial guy wouldn't, but why are you using DNA tests to get the information back? Is it strictly for market? Remember, this is anonymous, your little clicker thing, so you can answer this question completely honestly. Is it strictly for marketing? Do you think that information for something like marbling is better than the EPD? Is it for marker-assisted selection? In other words, you're using that information along with EPDs to try and make your selection decisions, or is it for future improvement of EPD accuracy? Once it starts getting incorporated, are you planning now for the future, in other words, of when that information will go into the genetic evaluation? Very good. How about that? 33% strictly marketing. Okay? Better than EPDs, about 10% of you. Marker assisted, so using it in combination, 23%. And then about a third of you are forward thinking about getting this incorporated into future EPDs. And we certainly, if nothing else has come out of this BIF, that is certainly the direction that it seems like everybody's on board to try and get to. It's a matter of just getting there now. Okay, we've got that already in there. So who in the crowd thinks that they might use DNA testing for quantitative traits in the future? So if you already do, of course, but there were a lot of you that didn't. So we're kind of curious from you whether you're at least thinking about it but not very convinced yet, and I have heard many producers that say that they would never use it. It's a strong word, but it's up there, and you can use it if you'd like. Okay? All right, 76% are still sitting on the fence. Very few, at least down there, in the don't think you ever will. And I think that it's going to probably be interesting to come back to BIF in a few years and just realize probably how widespread it is. I think particularly once we start seeing some real improvements in incorporation and some good solid results there. All right, for which traits would you most like to see an EPD? On a wide scale basis, let me put it that way, because I know that we have some of these scattered about already, but on a wide scale, every breed pretty much offering these. Tenderness, feed efficiency of the cow, feed efficiency of the feedlot calf, cattle health, fertility, or the healthfulness of beef. Feed efficiency of the cow, number one. Number two, fertility. So we are thinking about those input costs then. That's good to see, because that, I think, whether we're talking about fertility or that feed efficiency of the cow, that in some ways we're definitely talking about maternal characteristics of that cow. Feed efficiency of the calf did not get real high, which is a little surprising, and the healthfulness, although it's an important product, that's another one that's probably a little bit more pie in the sky right now, trying to strive towards. I think there is a lot of potential, and hopefully the benefits there are going to open up marketing opportunities for us. If there was a DNA test for weaning weight, would you use it? So that's just, I mean, I know that there's a lot of assumptions here, but I'm just saying, pretend I'm a DNA test salesperson, and I'm just coming to you and said that I have a reasonably priced weaning weight DNA test. Would you use it? But I'm very believable. Okay, about two-thirds of you said no, about a third of you said yes. Now, it's interesting that at least a couple of slides back, there was at least quite a few of you that were saying that you were starting to forward think about getting it into the genetic evaluations. If I were going to try and promote this or sell it, I mean, because the EPDs are pretty good now in terms of what we have. As a marker-assisted selection, I don't know how much benefit we could get. But if we could, but if you push it one more step further and start talking about accuracy, then it might be a little different picture, I think. So, is there value to increasing the accuracy of an EPD? It's the BIF accuracy, so absolutely it's accurate. Right, Tommy Brown? Okay. There at least should be some value, or most of you think there's at least some value in increasing the accuracy of an EPD. And you can look at this. Two very similar bulls in a lot of ways, except for the difference in the accuracy value of those two bulls, and you can see a considerable difference in the cost of the semen. Now, I know that's not it's a very anecdotal type of an illustration, and there's a lot of other things that go into all of this, but like I said, the EPDs across the board on these two bulls are very similar with very different differences in the price of their semen, and the big difference between the two is the level of accuracy. So how much... That was not supposed to happen. Okay, it's already... Did I switch ahead? Okay. Try again. There we go. All right. How much would you pay for a DNA test that increases the accuracy of a yearling's bull's weaning weight EPD from 0.05 to a 0.4? So now we're going to nail you down a little bit. And you can think of this both ways, because the seed stock guy, he's going to be thinking about how much more he can get for the bull, and the commercial guy, it's how much more he's likely going to have to pay for that bull. Okay, so some felt no value, about a quarter of you. But now, which is kind of interesting, because on the slide before, didn't we have 98% that thought there was some value at least in improving accuracy?
Improving accuracy, but there was a very large group, about 66%, that didn't think they would buy a test for weaning weight. So
right.
Now that was at a little disproportionate that I would give somebody for it.
Well, that's true. All right, so about a quarter of you said that you weren't willing to pay anything to get that improvement in accuracy. So I guess you could have been thinking when I asked before of going from 0 to 100% accurate, I guess. But this wasn't enough to entice you anyway. But most of you thought it was at least worth $1 to $10. Some more of you, about $20 to $50. And this is something that Allison put together where she was looking at the equivalent of bottom line. She was looking at the different heritability levels of either a 0.1 heritability or a 0.3 heritability and looking at BIF accuracies and the differences that it or what it takes to get that kind of accuracy based on that heritability. And so to get up to a 40% accuracy on a very lowly heritable trait, it takes about 70 progeny records to reach that on a trait that's as heritable like wean and weight, those type traits, about 22 progeny to reach that. So that's what we're talking about in terms of increasing from that 0.05, where were we? About there to there. So about 20 more progeny difference, and so you guys weren't willing to pay a whole heck of a lot more for that kind of difference in terms of progeny testing. So, see if you change your answer at all based on if you think of it in that perspective in terms of how many progeny you would have to do to improve your accuracy by that much. So now, how much would you pay? See if anybody would change their answer there anyway.
Basically,
yes, you may.
Because if you think about it, your DNA test is giving you as much accuracy as you can of protein test as 20 to the offspring. So that's what you can do at 9 So that's the improvement you're getting.
Surely that can't be right. There we go. No, it didn't change a whole lot. So we did a poor teachable moment there, Allison. So.
Are those 22 in 1 hertz or 7 hertz?
You tested 1 mole or 100?
Ask Allison. She put that slide together.
So the protein test is of 1 mole for 22 proteins. But you don't have to
so it would be at birth, basically,
right.
You get that accuracy. Absolutely. So at a yearling, you would have some increase in accuracy.
In 3 years,
right. All right, one last time. Now you get the option of increasing it from 0.05 to 0.9. So we've gone to an extremely highly accurate bull now, or EPD for his wean and weight on the bull. So would it increase what you or the value of that to you?
Bundle them together, so 20 But it's like every head weighs $150. So it started out with one, but how many people will bundle it in there?
Yeah, we've got it isolated, but you might get some fringe benefits on the side. You know, those commercials where you get the one squeaky pad for $9.95 and you get 12 more and all that. All right. All right, so at least y'all are willing to pay a little bit more. We kind of shifted it over at least about one notch, it looks like, for most of you. I would be willing to bet if we did a comparison, you'd probably be the same one. Yeah, some people are willing to pay quite a bit, aren't they, Allison? And on those, you better hope that he's a really, really good bull. And if he was a really, really good bull, then it would be worth a lot of money. I can see where you're coming from there. All right, for which trait would an increase in accuracy have the greatest value? All right, we've asked you just in general and mostly about weaning weight, but now we're going to give you the option to say, of all the traits or a lot of the traits that we have out there, which would you like to see able to get a higher accuracy rate at an earlier age? Yep. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, this one, it does take a little thought. Everybody in that wants in? All right, stayability. Let me see if I can explain this properly. It's longevity, right. So if you're satisfied with that, I won't go into the actual explanation of... Okay.
Okay. I've got to think of different worms and terms.
All right. So about half of you said stayability, about 10% marbling, and then various other ones. And I think you guys are absolutely on the right track, because what's the deal about stayability? It's a long way out there, right? So it would be beautiful if we could get fairly high accuracy at an early age. And it's a trait that certainly has some economic value to us. And so the other one, I guess I'm a little surprised that marbling didn't fare any better than it did, because it's another one that takes us a while to get to the information that we need to know. Whereas the other traits, our calving ease and some of those, at least we can get reasonably good accuracies early. Now, the reason I can see for something like calving ease is usually when folks are wanting to buy a bull with easy calving, that's where you can get into the most trouble if the bull does turn out to be an outlier in the wrong direction. And so I can certainly see we're trying to get a little better accuracy there. Certainly has some merit as well. All right, here we go. Here's the $20 million question. In your opinion, this is one of those I'm going to tell you right now, there's no right answer. Maybe. You're not going to get the right answer anyway. So which breeding practice is more valuable to the commercial producer? Selection, or the bulls he's buying from you guys that are seed stock producers, or his crossbreeding practices?
That's kind of an ambiguous question, because I don't care if you're crossbreeding or not, your selection, you're still going to select for the bull. I don't care if it's an Angus.
I'll agree with you. Let's see what we get for an answer. Okay. I agree that most everybody is probably going to be doing both. I guess the reason I would like to put it, the reason I wanted to put it in there is absolutely, I mean, crossbreeding needs to be done. I mean, period. I would have I would have been happier if it had been everybody put crossbreeding, I guess. Now, selection is certainly still important and still needs to be implemented. There's no question about it. I was just curious to see what everybody was thinking. Like I said, there's not a right or a wrong answer, and hopefully everybody's going to be practicing both of these that's in the commercial business, but just was curious to see what people's thoughts were. When put to the test, what you would have to vote for. All right, which current or past VIF president was observed to be in standing heat at this conference? Jimmy Holloman, Dave Nichols, Tommy Brown, or Brian McCullough? And I've got confirmation that one of them was in standing heat. Tommy. Hey, but don't worry, Jimmy. You got at least a vote. You voted for yourself. All right. I just want to bring attention to you that we're going to bring it to a close, but Alice and I are both heavily involved with the consortium, and particularly on the education side. One of the big efforts that we've put in over the past several months has been updating the website, so I encourage any of you that would like to go take a look at it, please do. I think you'll find it much friendlier than the last time. It's simple. It's www.nbcec.org. www.nbcec.org. And we've got good California producer there, Jack Talley. That picture is kind of funny. We went to great lengths to get this great picture with the Shasta Mountain in the background and this lovely mountain meadow and everything else. And I sent that picture into our website person. You see what came back. She squared him off. But I can see why, because if that picture was there at that size, you would just see a little stick figure there. So I guess she wanted you to be able to see Jack. I wanted you to be able to see the pretty meadow. But go and visit. Allison and I would be happy to try and answer any questions. Or if anything at this conference, there's enough minds in the room. If you aren't clear about anything that went on, ask the question and we can at least talk about it.
Let's go ahead and give them a round of applause.